On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we run through some of the most important injuries to come from the first week of spring training. Justin Verlander headed back to the Detroit Tigers. Nick Castellanos brought a beer into the dugout, and now he's unemployed. And it's Friday, so we give you the good, the bad, and the ugly. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that can't believe Nick Castellanos is being villainized for having a few small beers. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And I'm kidding. You can't do that. That's not okay to do. On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we will indeed talk about the shocking divorce that isn't shocking between Nick Castellanos and the Philadelphia Phillies. We've got a lot of injuries happening in the first week of spring training. Some fun signings. Justin Verlander going to the Tigers. George Schusterman, what state are you in right now?
I'm in Arizona. I feel okay so far. I have not undergone, you know, any sort of formal physical yet. Not planning on it. Hoping to just make it through my week in the desert unscathed. But we will see.
How's your hammock?
I'm certainly much more sensitive and hyper aware of how this tiny bone in my hand is doing. Let's get to it, Jake. The opener, spring training storylines. Everybody is injured.
Who is hurt? Who is healthy? And how unhealthy is everybody feeling? In the last week, we received news that Francisco Lindor of the New York Mets, Corbin Carroll of the Arizona Diamondbacks, and Jackson Holliday of the Baltimore Orioles are all dealing with hamate bone issues. That is a bone in the hand, not handmate, hammate. They will all, I believe, require surgery, and they will all be out for most of spring training. Corbin Carroll, who was projected to be a starter for the WBC team for Team USA, he's going to be replaced. But yeah, dude, this week is just like, it's just a list of ouchies.
Yeah, and I think that fans understandably, and I've thought about this over the years, it's like, why is this how this works? Are teams aware of these injuries for longer, and then only when all the cameras show up in their face on the first day of spring do they have to reveal it? I think in some case that is exactly what is happening. I think, obviously, we do hear about some injuries during the offseason. We've referred to Ha-Sung Kim slipping on ice and requiring more urgent surgery, a much more serious injury right off the jump. But what is your understanding for why this kind of gets reported? Because I sort of get it, but there's also still some confusion on my part.
Well, I just think that there's a difference between injured and hurt. And something that can feel uncomfortable can turn out to be worse than you think it is. If my hand hurts and I go and get imaging on it, it could reveal a real problem that's not going to heal itself. Guys are always dealing with things, and it is difficult to know in the off season when you're not around a training staff on a daily basis to know what's good and what's bad. Now, like, could a player like Corbin Carroll? I mean, Corbin Carroll seems different, right? Like, this seems to be an injury that happened, like, this past week, right? And I think the same is true with Lindor. Whereas you have these, you know, Spencer Schwellenbach being out for a while, that seems to be something that was revealed upon arriving to camp. So, yeah, it's just a product of the way that the season flows. And it is weird. It's like, hey, if you were feeling discomfort on January 9th, like, why didn't you get surgery then? Anthony Santander feels like an example of this. Blue Jays outfielder DH is going to be out for 5 to 6 months after getting labrum surgery. That contract is already looking abysmal, only a year into it. But yeah, it is an odd time because you get excited for the ball to be back. It's the warm weather down south in Florida and Arizona, and then your favorite player is hurt.
Yeah, I also think we have to separate hitters and pitchers from these conversations, because the ramp up process is obviously much different for both. I also think that with pitchers, you can imagine it's a little bit more nebulous, because we've had a range of some guys like Josh Hader dealing with a minor injury, but he's being like, nah, man, it's good. Just because I'm not throwing my bullpens yet doesn't mean, you know, to freak out. Shane Bieber, who we already sort of had a sense probably wasn't
getting ready for
opening day.
So I wanted to bring up Shane Bieber.
After reporting forearm fatigue. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so he's been diagnosed with forearm fatigue, which same all the time. I think this one falls in the middle where, like, we had heard some rumblings that Shane Bieber wasn't 100%, and yet the team hadn't fully announced it yet. Some of their moves over the offseason maybe, like, hinted at Shane Bieber not being 100%. Shane Bieber opting into this year of the player option on his deal was maybe a sign that he wasn't 100%. I think what this means for the Blue Jays rotation on opening day is very interesting because it will thrust Jose Berríos back into the rotation almost certainly with Gausman, Cease, Savage, and Cody Ponce. Quickly on Berríos, I think this is a good time to have this conversation. Berríos, who, like, huge character in the Blue Jays world before this past season, got an enormous extension with Toronto after being traded for Minnesota and just kind of disappeared during the postseason. He apologized for that this week as he attempts to kind of rebuild himself into a character in Jays land. I want to talk about Corbin Carroll, what his injury means for the Diamondbacks. I do think is significant because he's such a, I mean, he's the focal point of that offense alongside Ketel Marte. And the thing about a hamate injury, right, is like you come back from it within a pretty pretty set amount of time. It's between like 6 and 8 weeks, but you don't really get back to full strength right away. And your hand, I think, is an underrated part of your swing. It literally holds the bat, and it has been shown that players returning from hamate issues don't get to all their power, which has been a thing for Corbin Carroll specifically in the past, where mechanical issues, like his entire 2024 season, right, was derailed because he was overcompensating on some mechanical stuff. Now, he's a talented young man, and I'm not, like, worried about him being good again, but it is just something to monitor. But the fascinating ripple effect here is what it means for Team USA, because Carroll was going to start and left, probably, and now we have a number of dudes who are kind of the second wave here. They have to put someone on the roster. I would imagine that at this point you're allowed to just put anybody on that list who's pulled out.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know who was, presumably there was a larger pool of players that were already considering in the case that they couldn't have gotten Corbin Carroll to begin with. I know he was one of the earlier commits. John Morosi reporting names Stephen Kwan, Tyler Soderstrom, Riley Green, Roman Anthony, James Wood, Wyatt Langford, Kyle Stowers. I mean, all the ones you would guess. It will only be one of those guys. As for would any of those guys immediately start, the other outfielders on the team right now are PCA, Byron Buxton, Aaron Judge, Kyle Schwarber. But I don't think we're going to see Kyle Schwarber in the outfield. So this player is probably going to start.
I think the answer is going to start because Buxton and PCA have been in center field their whole lives. Like, those are not people that you're just going to put in a corner unless there's an emergency. I think this should be Kwan or Soderstrom. Mm. I think the rest of these players, like James Wood, should be in camp. Like, James Wood, if he gets the opportunity to come play in the WBC, like, he should do it, obviously. But his second half was so bad last year that I think he could do well to spend a whole year, a whole spring in camp. Langford is an interesting one. Roman Anthony, I believe, if Roman Anthony plays, Vinny Pasquantino is going to go kick his ass because
that's bad.
He had been asked to play Team Italy and whatever. So yeah, I think this is a very interesting thing to keep an eye on. One guy who's definitely not going to be starting in left field for Team USA and the WBC is Nick Castellanos. I feel pretty damn good about that.
How far down the depth chart? What number option? How many guys would have to break their hamate for Nick Castellanos to start in the outfield for Team USA? This is actually an exercise I might go through at some point today, but not 40? Right now on the podcast.
50?
Way more? Are you kidding me? He was the worst player in the league last year. I know not all the players better than him were American, but oh man, I think it's more than 50 at this point. I mean, I'm taking some minor league outfielders. I'm taking some. Anyway, Nick Castellanos, he's not going to be on Team USA. He might be on another team at some point soon, but let's not get to there so quickly. What we do know for sure is that it will not be the Philadelphia Phillies. We have known this for a long time, but it is official. They have released him. He has given his side of the story in a very Nick Castellanos way. We have some tremendous reporting from friend of the show, Matt Gelb at The Athletic, to give a little bit more context. And so let's talk about it, because this is the definition of podcast fodder.
Okay, so the timeline here, I think, is relevant of what we've known. We've been very upfront, like this was going to happen. There was no world in which Nick Castellanos was going to play for the 2026 Phillies. And I think when talking about Nick Castellanos, there are two separate things that need to be considered together. He was bad at baseball. He was not enjoyable to be around. I think you can probably be one of these things at any given time, but it is very difficult to be both of those things and keep a job in the major leagues, right? There have been worse players than Nick Castellanos to hold on to jobs that they probably didn't deserve, right? And there have been worse teammates than Nick Castellanos that there are right now, in fact, to play every day in the big leagues. Story from Matt Gelb in The Athletic about how this fell apart between Castellanos and the Phillies. Castellanos signed a 5-year, $100 million deal. This was going to be the final year of that deal. He's due $20 million. The Phillies are going to pay that anyway. They are paying Nick Castellanos $20 million to not play for them. That, in and of itself, is shocking. This is not something that happens often. We don't see teams cutting bait like this in such a blatant way when players decline. And I think that is what is relevant about Castellanos, is that his conduct behind the scenes was sufficiently inappropriate that it convinced the Phillies they could not carry him in any way for the 2026 season.
I mean, and he was quite bad, right? And so for a team that cannot just be giving out playing time to people, although I think in Matt's story, we learned a lot of Matt's story, and we can talk about the headline involving the incident in Miami is being referred to. We can talk, of course, we'll talk about that. But also just the how, even despite a reported rift here between him and Thompson, even before he was drinking Presidente in the dugout, and just kind of how that relationship was never really on the same page, that Thompson was sticking with him. He was out there. He played 30 straight games after he was drinking the Presidente in the dugout or had it in the dugout, whatever. And they stuck with him all the way to the bitter end in the postseason. And he still had his moments, even when he had his stretches when he was unproductive. I know that the injury to Harrison Bader is why he was still playing at the very end. But this dude got a lot of playing time, right? This was not someone that was slowly pushed aside from a playing time standpoint. And I know we now learn he was not happy with the spot in the batting order, but he was playing. Whatever the relationship was, he was playing, and by the end, it was not someone they wanted to move forward with strictly on the field, let alone off the field.
I mean, having been around this team a lot, there were people in Phillies land, players and staff, frustrated that Castellanos was getting so much leash, right, from Rob Thompson, a person who Castellanos has been incredibly open about disliking. You brought up the note. Yeah. That he wrote. Let's talk about the note. No notes app for Nick Castellanos. Going straight with the pen. Pen to paper. Handwriting, middle of the road. Not anything to write home about. When he's thanking people at the top of this note. John Middleton. Thank you for what you have provided my family with. Dave Dabrowski. Thank you for the opportunity. Staff. Thank you for helping me prepare. Paco Figueroa, who's the outfield coach. My teammates. At no point is Rob Thompson mentioned. Like, that is an obvious omission from Nick Castellanos' letter that he does not, and we, like, this is not a surprise, right? Like, he didn't like his manager. And that's fine. There are tons of players who don't like their managers. That's okay. What is not okay, and what is different, and what is unique, and what led to this release, is Nick Castellanos bringing a freaking beer into the dugout during a game and yelling at his manager in front of his teammates and in front of cameras. That's that simple. And for Rob Thompson to, after that, after suspending him effectively for one game or benching him for one game, for Thompson to be like, I'm going to play you 30 more times, is almost like too much taking the high road, right? And I think that is why the blame here rests predominantly with Castellanos.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. I think some of the reporting about why he disliked or did not respect Rob Thompson is also a little bit confusing. Matt writes that Castellanos in particular did not respect Thompson and Kevin Long, the hitting coach, because they did not play in the major leagues, which is a fairly outdated take to have in baseball in 2026. But Nick Castellanos is of an older generation of player. There is definitely a difference in how players his age see the world and Major League Baseball and their place in it.
Sure.
Than guys 10 years younger than him and what has changed. I will also point out, Paco Figueroa didn't play in the major leagues. So he seemed to do just fine. So I don't know. As usual with Castellanos, there was probably some inconsistencies and some contradictions along the way, but at the end of the day, it's what you kind of started this conversation off with, which is just you can't do both. You can be a turd if you're, you know, got a 900 OPS and a great defender, but
yeah,
this just wore thin on a team that clearly, this is another thing, right? We think we've talked about the Phillies and what's going to be different, and moving on from Nick Castellanos is a difference. That will be a difference in the room on the field. That I think clearly the way that they're talking about moving on to the kids and even trying something new with Adolis Garcia, I'm sure is viewed as a pretty dramatic alteration to the Phillies experience.
Yeah. And look, do I think that Nick Castellanos is an evil person, a bad guy? No, there were tons of examples of him being kind to younger teammates and like doing nice things for other people. He's not a horrible guy. And I think that the way that much of the baseball world consumes Nick Castellanos, someone who has always marched to the beat of his own drum, comes across in like clips and snippets of him being weird in interviews like once a month. Imagine working with that guy every day. Like, that has to get grating and exhausting and like wear on you. And it did. It, like, I know this having been around the team. Matt wrote this. It grated on people. And you can grate on people if you bang. Like, there's more leeway and leash for that. Nick Castellanos was not banging, yep, and he was carrying himself like he still banged, right? And I think that is what rubbed a lot of people the wrong way and why he's currently not employed.
Yes. As for where he could go, again, maybe I'm over. I mean, he's about to turn 34, so that's in theory is not like, all right, well, it's totally over. He has been healthy. He has been available, and so, but also a big part of this story, right, is this isn't someone that's going to go. So, I mean, maybe if this was some sort of huge wake up call, and he's going to go embrace a bunch of like driveline hitting trainers and change his approach and everything. Like, I don't see that happening, right? But there is potentially a role for him somewhere on some bench. Now, is he able to take that on? Is that something he wants? You know, John Heyman reporting there's a lot of interest. Other people reporting that there's not. I can see a few spots on a few depth charts that are plausible. San Diego would certainly make a lot of sense. But I don't know. Do I think Nick Castellanos has played his last major league game? I don't, but
I think he's played his last major league all-star game.
Okay. Wow. That's a real tyke. Thank you for for providing that. But yeah, so we will see. Obviously, because of this, if he does go somewhere else, he's going to then answer a whole new series of questions. And that will be, this will continue on to follow
him,
whether that's fair or not. And so we will see if Nick Castellanos has another chapter.
Because Nick Castellanos wrote this out for us, I do think it is worth reading the entirety of what he describes as Miami incident.
Because let's make sure we cover that and then we can take a break.
So I should say, like, this is something that was a rumor that was existing last year. Like, did we talk about it on the show, or were we talking about it off the show?
I mean, some version of this I had heard about for sure before this happened.
Yeah.
Before he let us know.
Okay. Apparently, I need to address the Miami incident, capital M, capital I, which kind of gives it like more. Although I guess he's doing capital I's a lot at the front of words. As one of my friends on the team has informed me, there is an article waiting to come out without my consent or comments about the situation. So I'm just going to share myself. That article, without Nick Castellanos' consent, is, I believe, a reference to Matt Gelb's piece in The Athletic, and shows a relative a deep misunderstanding of how journalism works. As a veteran of the game of baseball, there are rules, and I broke one in Miami. After being taken out of a close ball game, he crossed out one run and wrote close. You can see that here because it was a two-run game. Ball game in front of my friends and family, I brought a Presidente into the dugout. So this is important. Castellanos was removed in the eighth inning for defensive reasons because he is a bad defender. But because he is from Miami and all of his friends were there, he was embarrassed that this was done in his hometown, which is preposterous and selfish. If you are trying to win baseball games and you are a bottom five defender in the sport, and I assume Johan Rojas is around to play center field, just an iota of selflessness is warranted here. So he brings the beer into the dugout. I then sat right next to Rob and let him know that too much slack in some areas and too tight of restrictions in others, too spelled T-O, are not conducive, spelled wrong, to us winning. Shout out to my teammates and Howie, that is Howie Kendrick, for taking the beer out of my hands before I could take a sip. I appreciate you guys. So he did not drink the beer, okay? He just held the beer like a prop.
I don't understand this part, being like,
thank goodness
they stopped me from drinking it. I appreciate that. As if, like, what, he would have become, like, belligerently drunk? He clearly was already angry and yelling. So
yeah,
it's not like that had stopped him from how he was acting, but
I will never thank you for taking a beer out of my hand. That's for damn sure. After the game, I went into the office with Dave and Rob. We aired out our differences in the conversation. The conversation ended with me apologizing for letting my emotions get the best of me. I would like to note that I was ready to share the details of this incident in its entirety to the media the next day, but was instructed not to by management. Probably the right call. The punishment I received for my actions was the benching the following game. I love this game. I love being a teammate. I'm addicted to winning. I will learn from this. Here's the thing. If Nick Castellanos if this was a mistake, if this instance was a one-off that did not fit into his conduct the rest of his career, his time in Philly, I wouldn't have known about it last June when it happened, right? These things get kept in-house if they want to be kept in house, if the people they're about are worth protecting. And what I kind of gained from all of this is that enough people in Philly's land were willing to kind of chat about this. So it kind of spread out and ended up being public information. So anyway, Nick Castellanos, there were good moments in Philly. He had some productive-ish seasons. He hit two home runs off Spencer Strider, famously in game 4 of the 2023 NLDS, saving me a flight back to Atlanta that I did not want to get on at the time. So for that reason, I am thankful to Nick Castellanos. He is an interesting character in our sport. There are aspects of him that are refreshing, and there are aspects of him that are exhausting, such is the case with everybody, myself and Jordan included.
Before we take a quick break, just a quick shout out to Yahoo Fantasy Baseball. Fantasy Baseball is now open. It is February 13th. It is still cold, but opening day is right around the corner. There's no better place to play fantasy than here at Yahoo. There's upgraded draft tools for commissioners this year. Roster management is easier than ever before. And the Yahoo World is a social-first community. Fantasy feed, you can connect with millions of other players that are playing on Yahoo Fantasy Baseball. So sign up today. Do it or else. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's go around the league in 2006. Back when I was only 9 years old, a wee lad, a man by the name of Justin Verlander, was drafted by the Detroit Tigers, second overall in the 2004 MLB draft out of Old Dominion University. In the time since, Verlander has been around the block and back again. He spent 13 years with those very Detroit Tigers before writing a different story in Houston, winning his first World Series, winning his second World Series, winning his second and third Cy Youngs. Then he was with the Mets and the Giants for various amounts of time. And the 42-year-old, he turns 43 next week, is back, baby, in the D to rejoin the team that his boyhood club, the team that drafted him, where he made his name and made his money. Justin Verlander is on the Detroit Tigers once again.
Justin Verlander turns 43 a week from today. He has been very vocal in the later stages of his career that he wants to pitch into his mid-40s, late-40s, however long he can do it. There have been points over the last couple of years. The one thing you skipped over is where he went back to Houston. Now, that was a trade and not a decision to sign a free agency, but it worked out that he ended up back in Houston. And honestly, it's worth noting that when this offseason began, and before the Tigers added some other pitchers, before the Astros added some other pitchers, there was some speculation that he could go back to Houston again after his sabbatical in San Francisco. However, the Astros opted to go in another direction, but the Tigers, even after signing Framber Valdez and losing to Tarek Skubal in arbitration, decided, you know what, we do need a starting pitcher. Oh, guess what? They have an injury as well. We didn't mention it, but Reese Olson, a pitcher who has been dealing with a lot of injuries for them over the last handful of years, but is a very good starting pitcher that I think, if he was healthy, would absolutely be in their rotation. He needed shoulder surgery, and he is out for the year. So there was an opening, as we speculated, and leading up to spring training, we looked around at all the starting pitchers that had yet to sign, and we said, well, guys are going to start getting hurt, and guys are going to start signing. That has definitely happened this week with a bunch of moves that we aren't even going to get to all of them. But the Verlander going to Detroit is obviously the most interesting one. This is a pitcher that last year I was kind of bullish on. I saw his last start of the year in 24, even a season that did not go well for him. I listened to him reflect on that season and feel like he still had a lot to give, that he was starting to figure it out as he was getting healthy at the end of 24 with Houston. And when the Giants signed him last year, I was like, this is going to work. I think this is a great fit. I think this is a great place where he can succeed. And famously, it did not start well. He did not get his first, I know pitcher wins are silly, although who do you think cares about pitcher wins? Justin Verlander. And he didn't get his first pitcher win until
Nick Castellanos.
I think it was like June. Wow. Okay. You know when he got his first win of the season? This is kind of shocking.
It's like after the All-Star break.
It's like hard to even fathom. July 23rd, his 17th start of the year, he records his first win. At that point, before that start, he had a 4.99 ERA. He was 0-8, a massive loser, yeah. Justin Verlander was. But from that point forward, rest of the season, he posted 2-6 across his 13 starts and was just like totally solid. Solid number three, number four starter. And we should not be shocked. And this is this. We've said this about Kershaw at the end of his career, even when he was throwing 89. When you're talking about, we've said this about Scherzer, even as he's competed with diminished stuff. When you're talking about the greatest to ever do it, we should not ever be surprised when they figure out ways to just keep getting outs. And Justin Verlander showed that even after that rough start last year. And now he rejoins a Tigers team that, I mean, just congratulations to the Tigers social team, I would say. What a just gift to you. You already have, you're already feeling the high of like, oh, we got Scoobles here. We've got Tarek Skubal. We could just post anything Tarek Skubal and our fans are going to lose it in a positive way. Oh, now we got Fromber in there. And oh my gosh, Justin Verlander, join the club. The retweets are just soaring right now. So it's so cool. All the stories about the Tigers who had no idea this was coming, being like, wait, we did what? I think some great stories from I saw.
It's like, is Justin Verlander in camp?
He's on the ground.
Coach?
Right. But like, I mean, if you're, I think there were some examples, Parker Meadows and Dylan Dingler, who they didn't know this was coming. And it sounds like Justin Verlander just walked in. They were like, I know that guy. That's Justin Verlander. That ain't some NRI that I've never met before. That's the Hall of Famer. He used to be here. His picture's on the wall everywhere. Yeah, right. Exactly. But he's on the team now, and we'll see what he can give him.
Now,
I think that the degree to which we're now calling this the best rotation of baseball, or some people are really, really hyping this rotation up, is probably need to pump the brakes a little bit there. But I can understand why people are excited.
Justin Verlander is 34 wins away from 300 wins in his career. Last year, his former teammate, Logan Webb,
a lot of progress,
made 34 starts. If Justin, okay. He was the only person in baseball to make 34 starts. Justin Verlander, though, I mean, he's a legend. He could get there this year. If he goes 34-0 for the Detroit Tigers this year, or even 34-1, we'll give him one loss. He could get to 300 at home in Detroit. Now, wouldn't that be cool?
Is he going to pitch well enough to stick around? I don't know. Maybe. Going 34-0, I'll take the under on that. If anything,
okay, I'll take the over
because of the Tiger. Our questions about the Tigers' offense just as much as a pitcher going 34-0, but this will be something. This will be cool. It is not a stunning thing that he was willing to apparently defer essentially his entire salary to the 2030s in order to sign this contract. I think it's being reported as a $13 million deal with like $11 million deferred.
He's okay. He's doing okay.
Yeah. He's like, oh, wait, this is fun. I could be on the Tigers. I don't have to worry about making as much money as possible right now. He's made plenty of money. The one thing I did want to mention about this for the Tigers that I think is really interesting, and this is maybe it has more to do with Framber Valdez, but I saw a quote from Scott Harris and also from Justin Verlander about this kind of recent surge of Tigers spending, because this was a question, right? This was like, okay, is Chris Illich going to spend like his father did? It has not happened since Chris Illich has been in charge. And now it has in a very dramatic way. And Scott Harris kind of relays, he's being asked about the support from ownership, as most GMs are often asked. And you get these cliche answers all the time being like, oh, we have the support that we need, whether the payroll's $80 million or $180 million or $500 bajillion like the Dodgers. Obviously, Andrew Friedman's like, yeah, we're getting the support we need, folks. But even teams, even, Jerry DePoto is like, we get all the support we need. And Cleveland, we get all the support we need. Okay, great. But I think what Scott Harris said about this, he gave a very specific example. He said, he was talking about how, as we mentioned, when they signed Framber Valdez, that deal was reportedly agreed upon before they knew what they were going to be paying Tarek Skubal. And Scott Harris kind of relays this anecdote that he's like, when you call an owner asking before we even know about the Skubal results, saying, hey, can we make this significant investment, talking about this, huge AAV for Framber Valdez. And, he mentions, and Chris is even, he's even more excited on the other side of the phone than I am, or than we are. Like that makes you feel good, right? We also have this quote from Justin Verlander saying, you know, he's going for it again, like his dad did. We have a great ball club. I embrace that. I want to win. I think this is honestly, whether Scott Harris intended this or not, kind of some insight into how this operation is going, right? This tells me something that I think we already suspected, which is that Scott Harris was not. Because to me, you could read that and be like, well, then why weren't you asking for money all offseason long? If Chris Illich is Chris Ill itching to spend money, then what were you doing for 3 months, you know, not addressing anything? And it's, I think that Scott Harris didn't want to spend, right? He didn't want to go pay position players to block his young players that he believes in. And whether that strategy works or not, we're about to find out. But I think that's a great reminder of how these front offices don't necessarily operate. We assume that they always want to spend as much as possible, but sometimes that's not necessarily the case. And it's only when certain opportunities arise that the front office themselves are wanting to make that push. So I don't know. I just thought that was an interesting insight into this.
Other news notes around the league. Chris Bassitt spent the last couple of years in Toronto pitching out of the bullpen for the Blue Jays in the playoffs. Joins the Orioles on a one-year, $18 million deal. This is important for a number of reasons. Chris Bassitt is funny, and like I'm excited to have him around me. But it also pushes the Orioles' payroll to new heights. According to Matt Warich of the Baltimore Sun, the O's payroll now sits at $166 million, clearing their payroll from last year and the year before for the number one spot in franchise history. They're spending. That is a good thing. Good for the Orioles. How do you think Bassitt kind of slots into this group? Do you think he'll be in the rotation all year? Do you see him moving to the bullpen? He was so good as a reliever in October. He's still competent as a pitcher in the rotation right now.
Yeah, I mean, this is just like a way better version of these deals that they've been handing out recently to, I mean, this includes bringing back Zach Eflin, but obviously giving Sugano last year and Charlie Morton, where you're just trying to get a floor-raising veteran who will take the ball.
Yeah.
And Chris Bassitt has just been way more effective in that role than those pitchers. So, you know, he's 37. Could he decline and the ERA go up as the stuff gets worse? Yes. So I think there's still some risk here. I think knowing how he transitioned to the bullpen is a nice little backup plan, albeit a potentially expensive one if he's going to move into that role. But I think he fits great. It's, you know, the upside is still maybe lacking with this Orioles rotation, but this felt pretty necessary for the kind of season and roster construction that they are attempting. So from that perspective, I think it makes a lot of sense.
In other DMV news, Miles Michaelis joining the Washington Nationals. Jordan, did you see this?
Yes. Who reported this? Because I saw it. I was like, this probably isn't real.
That's not real. Jake Mintz first,
that
baby.
Can't be right.
Jake Mintz first, scoopity-doop.
Jake's never read about anything. This can't be a real thing. Miles Michaelis, here's a good place to start here. First of all, congrats on the scoop. Second of all, I'm looking at the Fangraphs roster resource, Nationals projected starting rotation, and Miles Michaelis is already listed as SP1. I do not expect Miles Michaelis to start on opening day. I hope he does not start on opening day. I know that this rotation is one of, if not the least proven rotation, literally in the entire major leagues. Yes, behind the Rockies. Yes, behind the White Sox. Yes, behind, like, it. This is 30. This is last. That doesn't mean there's not talent here that could surprise and end up with the 28th best ERA, starting pitching ERA. We like Kay Cavalli. We love JoJo Gray. We hope he comes back and pitches well. Maybe Foster Griffin is good. But that is not an accident. This is the only team where Miles Michaelis would show up. And smart people at Fangraphs would be like, you know what? I guess we got to put him in the top.
SP1. Look, Michaelis is going to serve a purpose on this team. Okay? Miles Michaelis, someone has to pitch for the 2026 Washington Nationals in a manner that doesn't threaten the future of the Washington Nationals, right? Miles Michaelis is there to gobble up innings that they don't want to give to other guys. and that's fine. That's a good job for a couple million bucks. I'm sure he's happy to do it. He, at age 37, is now the second player on the roster, joining Trevor Williams, who is older than the manager, Blake Butera. He is the first person on the roster who is older than the president of baseball operations, Paul Toboni. Mm-hmm. So that's fun. I don't know if we've ever had that before, a player older than a Pobo. But that is delightful. That is wonderful. And like, yeah, whatever, dude. Like, someone's got to pitch.
I mean, Miles Michaelis, it's a hell of a baseball reference page. Briefly debuted, you know, back in 2012, some time with San Diego, Texas, goes to Japan, and has now been basically one of the most durable starters in the league. Throwing very slow and giving up a lot of hard contact, but taking the ball is worth an amount of money, and he has continued to prove that. A couple more signs. Speaking of taking the ball.
Just quickly.
Yeah.
Nats fans. Just Google Miles Michaelis Lizard if you haven't yet. Michaelis famously in 2011 in the Arizona Fall League ate a lizard whole. That video has been sent by me to people in the Washington Nationals organization. So rest assured, the team is aware.
Well, that's good.
Lizard eating ways.
And it, like Miles Michaelis signing with the Nationals, if you hadn't done that, none of us would ever know. I mean, you better let him know.
We would never know.
This is our source of all information now. Speaking of pitchers, you're going to take the ball. Colorado Rockies have a couple new rotation members. That's Tomoyuki Sugano and Jose Quintana. Jose Quintana
adds to his list of teams.
This comes after they signed Michael Lorenzen. I actually love this. Are they going to give up a ton of runs? Yes. Jose Quintana, though, like, that dude just gets outs. He's going to find his way to like a 4-2 ERA. But this is not an accident.
I think he's going to be there.
I think he's going to be their all-star. The Rockies need to throw strikes. I know that sounds stupid because, again, their stuff might get clobbered. At the very least, this team needs to start throwing more strikes. So this is going to help. This is going to help move the game along, which is nice. But that is effectively what Paul DePodesta said when asked about these signings. And good for him. I am so excited Sugano is still around. This is like their first Japanese player in 20 years. And we will see. We will see how this goes. He is a legend. I mean, he's literally one of the best NPB pitchers of all time. So does that mean that the, you know, streets of Tokyo are now going to be lined with purple? Probably not. But it's a cool way to get involved, you know? It's a cool way to get involved. I really like it.
To get involved. Speaking of teams that dominate the Japanese market, the Los Angeles Dodgers had a flurry of moves yesterday, bringing back Kike Hernandez on, I assume he just has tenure at this point. 1 year. I mean, 1 year. The contract is as long as Kike wants to be on the Dodgers and isn't horrible. Now, the one thing to keep in mind is last year, the Dodgers did this with Chris Taylor and Austin Barnes, kind of, and they had to get rid of both of them by May. Now, Kike is a little bit better than that. He's a little more useful than that. I think he's got a little bit more institutional juice than that. But, like, there is no guarantee that Kike is going to play forever, though maybe he does prove us wrong. He was starting in the playoffs, like, he was starting all the playoff games. Is Kike going to start playoff games this year now that Kyle Tucker is on the team? Probably not, but probably. Neither result would shock me. They also signed Evan Phillips, a reliever who got Tommy John last year. I believe they non-tendered him and then took him as a free agent. He's back on the Dodgers. And then they gave Max Muncy an extension. Max Muncy, like the rest of us, is not getting younger.
I am about to go to Dodgers camp in a matter of minutes, and I'm very curious to hear a little bit more about this. Why Muncy was so proactive in wanting to get this done. I can understand wanting to be on the Dodgers as soon as possible. Max Muncy probably could have got a lot more money than this, which is just a $7 million salary, $10 million guaranteed, which I assume is like through a mutual option. If he had another good season, presumably he would get more than that. But I can also understand being like, you know what's fun? Being on the Dodgers. And you say the Dodgers want to get younger. That is not how they are acting whatsoever. And
nope.
I don't know what this says about their belief in, you know, the Alex Freelands, Hi-Sung Kims. Like, this is just such an interesting part of this whole Dodgers era. They are the oldest team in baseball. How long can they keep this up? And extending a player who is 35 and maybe was ready. He seemed like he could have been one of the first, like, good players that they start to move on from. Instead, they decide, nope, you are still our best option. They have a billion outfield prospects and not a lot of infield ones. They really don't. They have Alex Freeland, who they don't seem to really believe in that much. They don't really have much else. So it seems to be like they're trying to keep this infield together, and they will let the kids play in the outfield when they arrive and when Kyle Tucker does or doesn't opt out, I guess. We'll find out.
They should trade for the other Max Muncy from the A's. They can have both of them. That's the Max.
They should have been like
Max Muncy.
When the A's took Andy Ibañez to essentially play over Max Muncy, they should have been like, hey, can we at least have the other Max Muncy? That would have been fair. All right, let's take a break. When we return, a speedy edition of The Good, the Bad, the Ugly.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's do it. The Good, the Bad, the Ugly.
My good is very simple. It is not necessarily news, but yesterday MLB formally reintroduced the ABS challenge system, which will, of course, be in place this upcoming season. Talking about how last year's testing and spring training went, some of the results from that. You can read my story at Yahoo about that today. I just am so excited for this. And I wrote a little bit about the fact, and we're going to talk a lot more about ABS, so I'm going to keep it short here. But I am just so excited for how this is going to go. I'm so interested in ways that I have just not. This was so much different than the pitch clock, and I can't wait. And also, it's good because the most pressing thing now is that this will be in play in every spring training ballpark. Part of why what was, I think, last year the testing was a little bit uneven, strictly from a data standpoint and from a fan experience standpoint, is that it was only in half the ballparks, most of them in Arizona, a much smaller sample of them in Florida. Fans are about to get exposed to this system so much more, so much faster. And so while I don't think we're going to be able to glean much from a strategic standpoint in spring training, I just think all of us getting used to how this is going to work is going to be really fun. And this was just a refreshing reminder of that. So I'm very excited. It is good.
My good this week is the Mets' first day of camp superlatives. Many of these answers were bad, but the fact that they're doing it is good. Particularly would like to draw attention to one Mr. Craig Kimbrell, who, yes, is on the New York Mets. He's in camp on a NRI. And Kimbrell, his board here, season number 17, position right-handed pitcher. I would say relief pitcher, but that's fine. Hometown Huntsville, Alabama. We've been there. Hobby for Kimbrell is outdoors. More of a place. I love my wife and kids with a Z. Kids with a Z. That's good to love your wife and kids. His favorite artist was AI.
I just, it doesn't track with the rest of the board. I just don't understand this answer. Are we are we misinterpreting what this is? Like, it just doesn't make any sense. There's so many other Mets that I would maybe think this was an answer they were giving either genuinely or as a joke. So I just don't know what to make of this. I think this is a lot more ugly than good.
Well, I think the fact that he did this is good. I think this is hilarious. Is AI horrifying, and does it kind of smooth brain culture, particularly as it pertains to art? Yeah. Is it funny for Craig Kimbrell, of all people, to say that his favorite artist is AI? Yes. That is very funny, and I need to get to the bottom of this once I get to Mets camp. Maybe we can figure this out before the next episode. A couple other answers that stood out to me. Mark Vientos, who incorrectly wrote what number year it was for him in spring training. It is his fourth year. He wrote three. His hobby is, quote, creative. You ever do creative?
How do you do that?
I remember when I was growing up, my parents wanted like me to do stuff after school. They would put me in creative. Luis Torrens, his hobby is play any sports. Luis, I don't think that's your hobby. I think that's your job. Whatever. Luke Weaver, his favorite artist is, quote, my kids. I like that. I think that's a perfectly good answer. And then last, Jonah Tong's favorite artist, as he wrote, was Post Malone, which I have to say, no offense to Posty. I mean, he's got some bangers in the catalog. Don't get me wrong. But saying that Post Malone is your favorite artist, I just expected a little bit more from Jonah Tong. I just expected like a little bit more ball knowledge or like deep cut from a guy with his type of personality. That's all. That's the Mets superlatives are good. Every team should always do this. The legendary one, I believe, is the Jacob deGrom one, right? Where he said that his childhood hero was nobody.
Keeping it real, man.
These guys are hilarious.
He's like, look, I'm not going to lie. He's not going to give someone too much credit. It's Jacob deGrom. Let's go to bat.
Jacob deGrom's like high school baseball coach. I'm like, what the hell, dude?
I thought he looked up to me. All right, let's go to bat. This is a layup. Chris Getz, GM of the Chicago White Sox, I would say was exposed doing this, but like, no, he was speaking in a microphone all the time because he's a GM and people just notice something. This is from Sam Phelan on Twitter, who is, I believe, a White Sox fan. White Sox fans notice, hey, this is weird. Chris Getz keeps calling Luis Angel Acuña a switch hitter. So he put together a video four different times this offseason after they traded for Luis Angel Acuña, which, by the way, like, was not that long ago. Like, this is like in a pretty short amount of time that they traded Luis Robert Jr. For Luis Angel Acuña and Truman Pauly. I don't know if he thinks Truman Pauly is a left-hander, but this is a very weird mistake, and I don't think that it is a mistake. There's really no way around this. Like, you screwed up. What is good and ugly, though, is that Chris Getz had to clarify, because this clip went super viral, and so White Sox PR was like, Chris, you're gonna have to address this. And so he puts out a statement, which just like,
awesome.
Think about the premise here. Chris, we're going to need you to put out a statement on this. This is what Chris Getz said. And again, this is not, he did not say this. This was crafted. This was like written and presented to the media. So this is not like him on an interview, radio on interview, being like, sorry, guys. Like, this is exactly what he wanted to say. Although it sounds like he was saying this in, tongue in cheek. Quote, so I probably have been getting carried away describing his versatility. He can play every position on the field. Why does it have to stop there? I called Luis Angel and told him that even though he's just right-handed, we still love him. I mean, this is just, it's so funny. It's just like,
oh, what part I made of this? I made an oopsie.
Is this a disqualifying, error? No, we don't have to be too dramatic here, but there's not really an interpretation of this that is not flatly embarrassing. And I think that trying to paper it over with kind of a half joke via statement is both predictable, but also even more embarrassing. So bad, but also ugly.
It's not disqualifying, but it's certainly not qualifying.
Yeah, it doesn't make me feel better. It's not like, damn, Chris Getz nailed it. It's like, I'm not like, yeah, like, now we got to earn that back, right? We got to earn that back. So,
or you make Luis Angel Acuña start to switch hit to prove your point. Like,
yeah, are you just trying to manifest it? Like, is that part of the development plan? Is like, hey, I mean, some guys learn how to switch hit late in their career. It's very rare, but he would probably benefit from it. I agree. Like, I get it. I get why you would want him to be a switch hitter. He's just not.
One of the more bizarre storylines of early spring training is that Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, of all people, is on a warpath. Sure. IKF, who signed with the Red Sox for a unexpectedly high $6 million to be a utility man. He can't hit. It's just, that's a weird deal. Was a quote farm this week, first saying that the Blue Jays were more excited to face the Yankees than the Red Sox. And that got everybody up in arms about, oh, like, disrespectful. Aaron Boone was asked about it for some reason. And Aaron Boone was like, no, whatever. But what I want to focus on is IKF saying that he believed it was unfair that he didn't get a post-game interview after Game 7 of the World Series, after he was thrown out at home for what would have been the winning run to win the World Series. We talked quite a bit about this play. I think that there are a lot of smart people who are wrong about this play. I think the Blue Jays did this play wrong, and IKF was simply following instructions. However, he said, quote, "There were no cameras in my face after the game. If it was going to be such a big deal, it would have been nice to have the camera in my face and have a chance to speak." Guess what, IKF? You did have a chance to speak. This is from friend of the program, Ben Nicholson-Smith, at 1:51 a.m. local time, the morning after Game 7 of the World Series, with a quote from Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. Quote, "They told us to stay close to the base. They don't want us to get doubled off in that situation with a hard line drive." He explains the whole thing. This is on Twitter. You did get to talk. People went up to you in the locker room. No one went up to you with a camera, maybe, because I don't know if you remember, there was a lot going on in that game.
I also don't understand what that actually would have accomplished. Like, if you said this quote,
you wanted like
camera,
video content,
was everyone going to be like, "Oh, you're right. Sorry. Oh. You're good, man. Ah, good. You know what?
He's don't pivoting to video.
It. I will." Blue Jays fans, like, "I won't think about that play for the rest of my life. It's fine. We're good.
It was on video.
It's not a big deal."
You explained it on video? Oh, he explained it on video, guys. Also, like, players having to deal with us, like, in these moments after really tough losses is not easy. It's hard. And, like, it can be really uncomfortable to face it. And I do give players credit for doing it. It's also what the frickin' money's for. Like, that's where the money's kind of coming from in a way. But for IKF to be like, "You know what I really would have liked after the worst loss of my professional career is a camera in my face so that I could tell everybody why I messed up." Like, maybe he's that big of a man and I'm that small of a man. I just don't believe that. So for him to be like, "If only someone would have talked to little old me and I could have explained myself," when that's exactly what happened, is just disingenuous and just disconnected from reality.
Bad indeed. Let's go to Ugla. My Ugla is just something I've kind of been thinking about off of a little fun fact courtesy of Mike Petriello. Baseball Savant released you can search WBC data from last time, and obviously we'll be able to search it this time too, which is exciting. And he put out this leaderboard, which is just shocking, which is that by fastball velocity, average fastball velocity in last year's tournament, Team USA ranked 9th. I mean, behind Italy, behind Cuba, with guys that like aren't playing a lot of pro ball anymore. Colombia, like, this is, again, those teams have good pitchers, but it's just a shocking number. Okay, but what's ugly about this is just something I've been thinking about with the whole WBC discourse. Jorge Castillo just had a great story at ESPN about how Team USA assembled the best pitching staff ever. And I can't stop thinking about the flip side of this whole conversation, which is just a repeated emphasis at how terrible these pitchers were that represented Team USA last time.
Thanks and for I representing just, our country, but you were ass.
Yeah, like, I just, Miles Michaelis is in this bucket, Nick Martinez and Brady Singer and Kyle Freeland, and like, they're just catching strays left and right. Every time we talk about Team USA, it's like, "Well, we finally got some real pitchers." It's like, the reality is this staff was good enough to win the tournament. They almost did last year. When we talk about it, it's not like they were just getting blown out left and right and they didn't make it to the
Also, wasn't the final 3-2?
Yes, exactly. And so it's like, I just wonder how those guys are taking like, this discourse. Because
thank God someone took the ball out of my hand. Yeah, I suck.
Yeah, right. Are they like, "Yeah, man, I'm so glad Scooble's pitching. It's like, yeah, they're not stupid. They could look at it and be like, yes, this staff is better than when I pitched, probably. But I also imagine there's part of them that's like, what the hell, guys? Like, we went and pitched when no one else was willing to, and we still almost won. Anyway, I think that's ugly.
Oh, Adam Wainwright. Guys, like, what? Yeah, I don't throw 99, but you didn't hit. We didn't hit.
Yeah.
We scored two runs in the final, and now I'm getting dragged. The offense should be getting dragged from 2023. Justice for
offense is way better too. Yeah, no, it's like I just think Kyle Freeland just keep every time. It's like we were throwing Kyle Freeland out there. It's, come on, like. Anyway,
How bad it was. Bleak. It was so bleak. I mean.
Funny. People are acting like we're putting org guys out there. Okay, finish us off. Oh, and then I'll talk about college baseball for 5 minutes. Go ahead. What you got?
Speaking about pitchers being removed, Zach Wheeler told the media, this is from Lachlan March, who covers the Philadelphia Phillies for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Zach Wheeler kept the rib that was removed as part of the thoracic outlet surgery, and it's sitting in a closet in his house. There's a lot here. Zach Wheeler, who had a very, concerning injury last year, had to get a piece of his rib removed. Seems like he's going to be on track to pitch quite a bit this season. Keeping the rib is weird, but fine. I think I would inquire about that. When I got my tonsils and adenoids out as a kid, I asked to keep them. They said, you don't get to do that. That's not how this works. You cannot keep your tonsils. They go in medical waste. The weirdest part about this is that it's just sitting in a closet, right? Is that agreed. It's not displayed. It is not like in a case. It is not like a piece of art. It's just in his closet, like with his ties. And his, dress shoes and whatever, and his cufflinks. Like, what should one do with one's own rib is certainly a difficult question to answer. I do not envy Zach Wheeler for having to determine what to do with his rib. I just don't think this is the best option, leaving it in the closet. What would you do with your rib? Email us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com.
Yeah, like I've heard of this being a thing as like a look at this thing I went through. But right, in theory, that would then motivate you to somehow display it or like turn it into like a necklace or a like I know this just sounds weird. It depends on what medical procedure you're talking about. But yeah, it's like, well, then if it's just going to sit in the closet, then why bother taking it at all?
Great tweet. This is from @ Loud Goblin. Quote tweeting this news and saying, thanks for telling everyone where it is, genius. Bryce Harper is going to use it to make broth now.
Oh, that is just so disturbing and so funny. All right, let's finish up this episode so I can get to Camelback Ranch. I will be going to the first day of Dodgers camp today. But after that, I will be watching some college baseball, not just on my phone and the computer, but with my own two eyes. There's all kinds of college baseball opening weekend here. And listen, we love college baseball. Tony Vitello's not in it anymore because he's managing the Giants, which is weird. But that doesn't mean there's not a ton to be excited about. Just a couple quick hitters to monitor this season. We will, of course, be checking in on it throughout the season, but want to give it some love on opening day. UCLA Bruins, number one team in the country. Rock Chalowski, number one player in the country, heavily expected to be the number one overall pick. But it is rare to actually go wire to wire as the 1-1 guy that everyone says is going 1-1 and then actually goes 1-1. Will the White Sox take Rock Chalowski? Who knows? How will the UCLA Bruins do in the Big Ten? They've been in the Big Ten now for a little while. I'm going to see the Bruins open up their Big Ten schedule in early March in Columbus, Ohio. Isn't that funny? Classic Big Ten rivalry, UCLA and Ohio State. But UCLA Bruins are definitely a team to know. LSU has won two national championships in the last 3 years, of course, with Paul Skeens in 2023. And then they just won again last year. Can they continue to win despite keep getting all these players drafted. Cade Anderson is now in the Mariners. They had a bunch of other guys picked. They bring in some new transfers, but they have some very interesting players that I'm sure we will be talking about as the draft approaches. Can LSU continue to dominate? And then the other team I definitely want to shout out is Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech probably has the best offense in the country. Drew Burris is a 5'9", generously. I think when Drew Burris gets measured for the ABS system, he is not going to be 5'9". But for now, he gets to be 5'9", and he is one of the most exciting players in the country. And he's also going to probably be a top 10, if not top 5, if not top 3 pick. And he is leading a Georgia Tech offense that is one of the most ridiculous lineups we've ever seen. So they're going to score a bunch of runs. Can they prevent enough runs to be an Omaha team? We are going to find out. Shouts out to their new coach, James Ramsey, taking over for Danny Hall, who had been there for a very, very, very long time. If you like college baseball or want to get more into college baseball, let us know. We could try to help you in that venture. We'd love to cover it to the best of our ability. D1 Baseball, shout out to those guys. My goodness, what a resource. What an incredible team of writers, podcasters, personalities that they have over there. Cannot recommend their work enough. D1Baseball.com. All right. We're done. I'm going to Dodgers camp. Thank you, Jake. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. As always, you can email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. And we will be back on Tuesday. I will still be in Arizona. And we'll see what I've seen by then. I will talk to you all then. Bye-bye.